From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Berkeley, California.
Berkeley.
Albany.
Alameda.
The Presidio.
Coming up, San Francisco celebrates Pride this weekend, and we're celebrating on the airwaves. First, we'll visit two dads raising a daughter.
Filling out the application to get her a Social Security card. It's mother, father. We're both fathers. And she said to me, well, pick one.
Then we meet some of San Francisco's biggest boosters.
And I saw them, the whimsicalness of people going in the air and the cheerleading. I said, maybe this is my call to action.
And we find out the answer to this week's audiograph mystery sound.
Just to have that space that you could walk into and always feel safe. That's what this was for us.
We're loud, we're proud, we're Cross Currents. Stay with us. This weekend is San Francisco's 45th annual Pride celebration. It's one of the largest LGBT gatherings in the country, and the theme, Equality Without Exception, runs through all the events. The trans parade, the dyke march, and of course, Sunday's big parade down Market Street. But this open expression of inclusion isn't a given. 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 and paved the way for gays and lesbians to marry legally in California. Since then, state after state has struck down laws against gay marriage, but not all states. The Supreme Court will soon release decisions on legal challenges to gay marriage bans in Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Michigan, and rule on whether it's unconstitutional to deny same-sex couples the right to wed. These decisions could have larger implications for other states, including California. Today, we'll meet a gay married couple who are trying to figure out equality at home by learning how to share the responsibility of raising their daughter. KLW's Jen Sheehan brings us the story.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I'm visiting Amos and Mickey Lim at the home where they live with their six-year-old daughter, Alicia.
Daddy, I want to play with her for 1 minute.
Alicia calls Mickey Daddy. Amos is Papa.
Put your lunchbox in your bag first, please.
Yeah.
And make sure your homework's in your bag.
Yeah, where's your homework? Is your homework in your bag?
When Amos and Mickey met in 1995, they had no idea they'd someday have a daughter together. It didn't seem possible. They first connected online on a gay discussion group.
Somebody was talking about long-term relationships, how there's no such thing as long-term relationships, probably because we don't see the role models out there.
That was certainly true for Amos. He's from Singapore, a country where homosexual acts are still against the law. Mickey was living in Bakersfield at the time. They started corresponding. Long emails turned into long phone calls, and a couple years later, Mickey went to visit Amos in Singapore.
And then we met and immediately realized, oh, well, we're in love.
Almost 20 years later, that love plays out in an everyday way in the home they've made together. Amos is in the kitchen washing the breakfast dishes. He says he and Mickey share responsibility for domestic duties. There's not a clear division.
I don't see it as a 50-50. I see it as a 100-100.
Yeah.
You know, I'm reading the book and he's cleaning the kitchen. If he's reading the book, I'm doing something else, you know.
Who put the handrail?
Goodbye.
They head down to the front door as Amos waves from the top of the staircase. Mickey's going to drop Alicia off at school, then drive to his job as a pharmacist for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Amos is the volunteer director of a nonprofit, but he calls himself a stay-at-home dad. He'll pick up Alicia in the afternoon.
I think we both want to participate in the raising of our child. And yeah, it is 100% and 100%. Nobody gets any downtime here. It's all go.
I'm tired.
They share duties like this for a reason. When Amos first came to the U.S. in 1999, he had a series of temporary visas. His status was often uncertain.
And the fact of the matter is that if I get pink slip or if I get fired, I have 10 days to leave the country. And it's already stressful, the two of us just trying to maintain a relationship and stay in this country.
The instability affected how they ran their household. For example, because he came in on a student visa, Amos couldn't work for several years after he arrived.
So, but what we've done and what we continue to do now is that you contribute to the house, the family, that which you're capable of. No one thing is one person's job. It all has to get done.
Amos finally got his green card in 2006. He and Mickey then started the adoption process and were matched with Alicia through a foster to adopt program. She was 8 months old.
At the point in time, I was working full time. We were fighting Proposition 8, but I had taken some time off. So
he took his month off and then I took my month off.
Yeah.
When the economy tanked, Amos lost his job. Alicia was receiving therapy for developmental delay 6 hours a week, so they decided that Amos would stay home with her. Mickey, once again, would become the sole breadwinner.
Hello! Hi!
Around 6 o'clock, Mickey comes home from his day at the pharmacy. Amos is putting dinner out on the table.
Do you want me to cut it up?
Does it have cheese on it?
No, and you have to wait first, please. Wait for all of us, please.
Mickey and Amos both say that the models of parenting and partnership that have been handed down to them don't always apply to their family.
We don't fit into the, I'm the husband, or you're the wife, or this is what husband do and this is wife do, because we do both.
But both men say they've felt the discomfort of not conforming to traditional expectations. Not only are they two men together, but they're the primary caretakers for a young girl.
Filling out the application to get her a Social Security card.
Yeah.
It's mother, father. All right. We're both fathers. So, and she said to me, well, pick one. All right. Since I took his name, I'll be the mother.
Mickey says they've also been surprised by how some of their friends have reacted to their decision to raise a daughter.
The straight couples with kids are actually more accepting or more shrugging of their shoulders of it than gay people.
Gay people without kids?
Gay people without kids.
What do you think that's about?
I think it goes back to, why are you going that road that is so what they have rebelled against? Again, not understanding that you can make it whatever you want. Not the life that you ran away from, but rather the life that you're walking and running toward.
Okay, you're sleepy.
Right now, these three are running toward the end of their day.
I'm going to call Daddy, okay?
Daddy!
Halfway into her second storybook, Alicia is fading. Mickey comes into the bedroom so that Daddy and Papa can tuck Alicia in together.
Good night.
I love you.
Good night, Daddy.
Eventually, these two fathers will get to sleep themselves, only to wake up tomorrow to do it all over again. For Cross Currents, I'm Jen Chien.
That story first aired in January 2014. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Events like Pride are created to celebrate families like the one we just met, the Lin family. Now we'll hear about who you might see perform at those celebrations, cheerleaders. Cheer San Francisco got their start performing at LGBT events around the city. And last month, it became official. They are now San Francisco's official cheerleaders. KLW's Stephen Short bounced by one of their practices recently and has this report.
Stop by Head Over Heels Athletic Arts in Emeryville on most Tuesday evenings, and you'll hear sounds like these.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1...
Tuesday is when members of Cheer San Francisco work on their routines.
You've got the technique down now. It's like you feel it, and you can do it from low.
This is a group of about 40 adults, the majority being well over the traditional limber age of most gymnasts. They're about equally divided between men and women. And while it started as an exclusively gay group, the number of straight participants has recently increased. They're all dressed in red t-shirts emblazoned with the group's name. They clap, twist, lift, laugh, and groan as they focus on instructions.
Also, for the people in the back that are doing this, make sure it's an O and not a straight arm, because that's noticeable too. Yeah? All right, again.
It's a good workout. But Win Pham, the group's communications director, says that's not the main reason these folks are here.
We are here to help people. We're here to entertain. We're here to inspire. We were founded in 1980, 35 years ago, as a performance team that basically donated a few performances to LGBTQ sporting events around the Bay Area.
The group lays claim to being the first all-male gay-identified cheerleading team in history, starting out in Hayward as the Raw Raws. They were an instant hit at gay events, and their popularity soon led to the idea of using their talents to raise money for worthy groups.
We like to say we are philanthropists who choose to do so in the form of cheerleading.
Salvador Tovar of San Francisco is one of the long-haul performers. He's been with the group about 9 years.
And therefore, we go out there raising money for just different life-threatening challenges, such as HIV, AIDS, breast cancer, foster care.
Tovar didn't find his way into cheerleading until adulthood.
When I was in high school, I always had that passion, but during that time, it wasn't accepting to have men as cheerleaders.
But one day, at the Castro Street Fair, he unexpectedly encountered Cheer SF in action.
And I saw them, the whimsicalness of people going in the air and the cheerleading and the crowds watching them, that I said, maybe this is my call to action. This is where I can go ahead and try to join a community of cheerleaders.
This looks great. A lot of people, when you're turning to do this move, you're staying here.
There are two main positions in this form of gymnastics: the base, sometimes called lifters, and flyers, those being lifted. The group is noted for routines where performers are tossed into the air, high into the air. I've seen this, and it can be frightening to watch. Belinda Lau is a lifter. She joined Cheer SF 2 years ago, but she's been a gymnast since she was a child. How hard is it to get people to trust you, to throw them up in the air and know that you will be there when they're done?
They're pretty trusting right away because they know the people who make it on this team. You know, we proved ourselves to protect and basically, yeah, to save them, essentially.
After the second basket, I want you to walk out just as far as you can go, but to where you'd be in the pyramid and practice getting there in time and seeing if it's even possible. Okay?
All the routines are practiced until they could probably be performed blindfolded. Not that anyone has tried that. So Cheer SF members are confident that they can count on each other. But practicing in a controlled environment is far different from performing in the real world, according to Win Pham.
We have to work with what we're given. It'll sometimes be a carpeted conference room or an auditorium or a ballroom, and it might oftentimes be the asphalt on Market Street.
But Pham says their main call to action is gay pride parades from San Jose to San Francisco. Belinda Lau says it's these outdoor events that can pose the most problems.
Yes, we are performing on cement most of the time, on pavement. So it's definitely not regulated. NCAA would definitely shun us, but that's what makes us extra careful.
Then there are the unknowables of outdoor performance, such as getting sun in your eyes or dealing with intoxicated spectators.
You have some people who are enjoying the festivals too much that kind of go into the wrong place at the wrong time. So you just have to be aware.
Randomly staggering into a performance that has been developed over months is highly discouraged. But Cheer SF is indeed open to anyone interested in trying out.
What we were hoping to see was this and some kind of, like, big finish.
And while everyone cheers the fact that they've raised more than $300,000 for nonprofits over the years, Salvador Tovar reminds potential recruits that there can be more to it than lifting, flying, and fundraising.
This group has, for me, has been an amazing family and an amazing way to give back to the community, and therefore I plan on being part of this team as long as I'm here.
In Emeryville, I'm Stephen Short.
Hi, Stephen! You're special!
For Cross Currents.
Cheer San Francisco performs on the main stage at San Francisco's Pride Celebration, both Saturday and Sunday at Civic Center. More information is at klw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's Audiograph's Julie Kane.
For this week's Audiograph, we've been playing you this sound.
Queer women and trans men and just queer folks in general, just to have that space that you could walk into and always feel safe. That's what this was for us.
For the answer, we bring you a story that might sound culturally and geographically impossible. The closing of what many consider to be the last lesbian bar in San Francisco. The Lexington, or the Lex as it's affectionately called, was a watering hole for thousands of queer women and trans men for close to 20 years. But rising rents recently added it to a growing list of San Francisco's queer venues that have shut their doors for good. What does last call at San Francisco's last dyke bar mean for the city? KALW's Christina Loring takes us to closing night at the Lex.
The first time I came to the Lex was back in 2009. I'd just moved to the Bay Area from Portland, Maine. I was 24, super femme, and I didn't have any queer friends here. I went to the Lex on a mission, like so many baby queers before me, looking for the mysterious lesbians of San Francisco that I hoped would be my kin, or at least make out with me. Same old story.
You know, some queer gets off the bus. It's like, where do I go? The Lexington, okay.
That's Blair Craig. She's been coming to the Lexington since it opened in 1997.
Then you sort of sit there and look around and eventually talk to somebody and eventually you find your people. And I think that's what's important about the Lexington and what was important about the Lexington.
What was important about it was having a place that would always be there, a queer space that was always open. And tonight, that outpost is about to be gone.
It's heartbreaking on a lot of levels because it's not just, oh, this amazing queer space that was a safe place for a lot of people, regardless of sexuality, that's gone.
That's longtime patron Jennifer Chachna.
But it's a sign of the way that money is changing San Francisco and the way that the neighborhoods are changing, so it covers a lot of ground, so being a bummer.
The Lexington is like a national park, like you're glad that it exists, but maybe you don't visit all the time, but you appreciate that it's there.
Gabby Miller jokes she hasn't been to the Lex in years, but she's here tonight to pay her respects. That's because tonight's kind of like a wake, one of the loudest, sweatiest, most crowded wakes I've ever been to. A fitting swan song for a place that's more like a person than a bar.
If the Lexington was a person, it would just be the warmest, cuddliest, most accepting person ever.
They would be genderqueer. They would be wearing a lot of black, leather, some leather, tattoos, sexy.
They would be an old chiseled butch like me.
A little wild, a little feisty, comforting, and a beast that cannot be tamed.
I mean, it's amazing. It's people accepting you for exactly who you are with no caveats, no buts. When you come out and you get to be like, come the full you to everybody. I mean, I was lucky to have a family that accepted me, but a lot of people don't. And these people they accept you.
That's the thing that separates the Lex from any old dive bar.
You're surrounded by different people all day long. Sometimes you just want to be around people you know and, you know, people that are like you. And, you know, there's no really place you can go like that, you know?
That's Randy Turner. We're standing outside under the neon pink and blue letters of the Lexington sign. Clusters of women mingle on the sidewalk, chain smoking and crying. It's 10 p.m., 4 hours till last call. 4 more hours till the doors close for good.
I mean, it sucks. I mean, there really is nowhere to go. I mean, I think I've seen a lot of comments of people saying, well, we don't need these kind of spaces. It's like, well, you kind of do.
It's a question being debated between shots of alcohol tonight. Do we still need lesbian bars in the queer mecca of San Francisco? Things are different now than they were when the Lex opened her doors back in 1997.
The mission was really different. When we opened, it was largely a Latino neighborhood, but also a huge neighborhood for dykes and lesbians and queers, and also artists and musicians.
Lila Thurkild is the owner of the Lex.
A lot of lesbian-owned businesses, and that's just where everybody kind of lived and hung out, so it was the natural place to open the bar.
Thurkild wanted to create a gathering place that would always be there, a staple, a beacon, a living room for queers.
We never closed over the holidays because even though we would lose money every year on that, it was so important to have a space that was always there for people that couldn't go home or felt like they needed that surrogate family. And even if it was just one person that came in, we would stay open because we felt like that was really, really important.
But after nearly 2 decades of keeping the doors open, no matter the cost, the landlord doubled the rent. The Lex couldn't afford to be in the mission, and neither could her patrons.
The key thing is that when those things start to happen, who do you see that happen to first? Well, the minorities, and the minorities within those minorities, you know? It's not surprising that the places that are already on the margins and have to struggle to be there to begin with are the places you see dropping off first.
While the effects of gentrification and the displacement of queer culture have dominated a lot of the headlines about the Lex's closing, Thurkild thinks some people are missing another very important point.
A lot of people like to talk about the closing and the climate and why it closed, and I think that's all important, but I think it's also really important to talk about, well, why was it open for so long?
One clue is in the slogan. It started out as your friendly neighborhood dyke bar, and then changed to your friendly neighborhood queer bar. As the trans movement grew up in the bar, its clientele diversified, and the Lex welcomed the change. It's nearly 1:30 a.m. Last call looms. People cool their sweaty bodies with a few last sips of whiskey. Lila Thurkild cues a very important song on the jukebox. We Belong by Pat Benatar. It's become the Lex's unofficial anthem, an anthem with a message. Although the Lex is closing, queer identity in San Francisco is here to stay.
We're going to miss you dearly, Lexington. Very, very dearly.
Thank you for letting me become me.
We'll miss you, Lex. We love you.
And that's it. Last call. As people spill out into the street, I can't help but think of it as a large metaphor. These doors are closing, but the essence of the Lex is dispersing beyond her walls. Her evolution of identity almost mirrors my own. I'm not that self-conscious baby queer I was when I first came to town. I'm almost 30. I've found my homo family. My girlfriend and I are shacking up in Bernal Heights next month. I finally realized that there's no one way to be queer. And since there isn't one queer space, I'm making my own wherever I go. For Cross Currents, I'm Christina Loring.
Our audiograph winner this week is Elizabeth Oscar Maynard. Congratulations! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt.
Many times I tried to tell you.
For the rest of you, we'd love to hear your ideas for where we should record next. give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And a quick shout out to the folks who've been calling us this week with suggestions for a cleanup slogan for San Francisco. Our favorites so far are
Pride, it's not just a weekend.
And
Keep San Francisco Sexy.
Keep them coming, folks. We can't wait to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling. I'm Julie Kane.
You can also email us at news@kalw.org or catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Let us know how you plan to celebrate Pride. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Allison Lee, Timothy Lou Lee, Holly J. McDeed, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Rafi Ronquillo, Raja Shah, Lizak Shalit, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Nina Gensler-Debs. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.